pressing example right this very second. So you could process asylum claims within 30 to 90 days instead of 2 to 3 years. You know, we need 1,000 more judges at the border, asylum judges, and then we could actually process people as they're coming in. And only about 10% of people coming across the border are valid asylum claims. The other 90% want to come here for work. We should have a guest worker program for them if there's an employer that wants to pick them up and have them work.
First of all, I think it's awesome that you're taking on probably the world's biggest challenge, and that is running for president of the United States. It is such a thankless job. And, you know, I always tell people this is one of those jobs where there is no training. It's not like you get elected and they're going to say, okay, we're going to give you 6 months to get ready or a year to get ready. You're going to go to a special school. No, this is like you won. Here's the transition period. And then boom, you're right in it.
Boom. Millions of employees, all kinds of things going on at the same time. Yes.
You're immediately loved and hated by millions of people. And
That's right.
oh,
That's
it's
right. That
crazy.
already happens just when you're running for office, let alone actually get there, right?
True. I forgot about that. Yeah. All right. Well, all right. So I did a little research and I let's see. Let me get to my notes real quick. So,
Very fair.
one of the things I found out, and I thought this was kind of interesting. I wanted to get your background on this. And Paul LeBlanc's book, Broken, you attribute to inspiring you to run for president. Talk about this.
Yeah, absolutely. So I read the book in the summer of last year. And do you, I don't know how much you or your listeners know about Paul LeBlanc, but I'll kind of go into it a little bit. He's the president of Southern New Hampshire University, which used to be a little tiny university in Manchester, New Hampshire, with 2,500 students about 20 years ago. And over the last 20 years, he's grown it to now be 225,000 students. It's the largest university in America. Many people still haven't even heard of it, even though it's 3 or 4 times larger than Ohio State University or University of Texas at Austin. And he wrote a book called Broken, which was about kind of applying the lessons learned from running Southern New Hampshire University over the last 2 decades to big social problems like our healthcare challenges, our prison problems, homelessness, climate change, you name it. And it's almost like a window on the universe opened up, and I realized, wait a minute. I see how we can make the world better and equitable for everyone. And I read it twice, once fast and then once slower, taking notes. And then when I was up campaigning in New Hampshire, he was generous enough to do a town hall with me and we talked about it. And I still think he is somewhat in disbelief that he's a big part of why I decided to run for president.
It shows you that books, authors, messages, ideas make a difference. I
Totally.
mean,
I'm all about ideas make a difference. In fact, I kind of am almost a collector of ideas. I have more than 1,000 ideas in a folder on my
I love
desktop
it.
of, you know, some of them are billion-dollar ideas that I think could be made into companies. Others are world-changing ideas. If I could go into this for a second, I was at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for a number of years, and we were working on improving post-secondary education, helping more low-income and minority students get into college and graduate from college. And that was the main focus of my work there, innovation to help improve college outcomes. But the Gates Foundation kind of taught me that everything that you're trying to change in the world can be measured. Like they actually have a giant scorecard for all 27 of their strategies, from malaria to improving higher education to financial, what was that one called? It's like basically like financial simplicity so that there can be financial systems in various parts of the globe, like microfinance. And they were able to compare like which ones were actually better ROI for improving people's lives. Anyway, at the end of all this, I realized the number one idea at the Gates Foundation that's probably going to change the world the most are these three people working in kind of a back office. They don't even get like nice offices. They're kind of in a corner. And they're the Giving Pledge, which I'm sure you probably heard of.
yes.
It's like Warren Buffett has now given 99% of his wealth. And so all these other people, and they're up to like 500 or 600 multiple billionaires who have agreed to donate so much of their wealth to charitable causes. And it's three people. Three people have, not done it all on their own. Obviously, all these wealthy people have to choose to give back at the end of their
Right.
life or whatever stage of life they're at. But just imagine those three people have probably persuaded half a trillion, maybe $1 trillion in capital to go towards improving the world. And that's pretty incredible if you think it's just three people.
That
I think there were
it's a
50 people in our group trying to improve college outcomes, and it improved from like 55% graduation rate to 62%. That's something. But those three people moved half a trillion dollars or $1 trillion of capital.
Yeah, it's incredible. First of all, the idea of the giving pledge is a big idea. It's a huge idea. And of course, it got a lot of spotlight. First, Bill Gates announced it. And then second, I think Warren Buffett embraced it wholeheartedly.
They did like a three-person thing on Charlie Rose or one of those other shows. And it's interesting because the Giving Pledge, people just think it's three words, but it really is like an idea that once you
Right.
get that idea in your head, and then you could execute on that idea. And it's amazing what it can accomplish.
Absolutely, absolutely. What's the old saying? That a few dedicated people can change the world, and typically that's what it is. I mean, America was
That's kind of
founded.
what the phrase is. Like it's
Yeah.
the only thing that's ever changed the world or
Thank you. It's
something
the
like
only
that.
thing that, and you can, and if you look at our history, it was a few founding fathers who said, we got to do this differently. It was, it wasn't 100,000 people or even 1,000 people. It was just whatever. It was a few people. And then that idea grew to maybe 20 or 30, and then whatever. And then you had a whole Revolutionary War behind it. So it's just a few people, a few dedicated people will change the world over and over and over again.
Totally. And I respect what they were able to accomplish in a way even more because they didn't have emails and phone
Right.
calls and like I would see that guy Thomas or that guy John like once every 2 years and we really bonded and then we came up with this document and Benjamin was there too.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Even, again, they had access to mail, but mail back then would still take you several weeks, a month, a year. I mean, because if you were sending something overseas, it's going to get on a ship, and assuming the ship makes it through, you may get that letter, and then, of course, correspond. All right.
This really, I mean, I know we're kind of off topic in a way, but this really came up during the pandemic when, you were probably on Twitter too, as I was, and I was like, wait a minute. They're sequencing this virus in real time, and there are all these different like variations, and they're all contributing to a database from all over the globe. I mean,
Right.
it's an incredible amount of knowledge sharing. Like that's so far away from putting a piece of mail on a ship and having a 90% chance it gets there in 3 months,
Right. It's incredible. All right. So I got to ask you, I think a lot of people were shocked when the Gates decided to divorce. Did that also take you by surprise?
It did take me by surprise. I worked with them for 3 years and we probably saw or were in the same meeting once every 2 months or something like that. And to all visible intents and purposes, they were very close. They loved each other. Clearly, this was not something that was like brewing for multiple years. It kind of came to a head in a very short amount of time. And then they got divorced and we were all very sad, including all of my colleagues that I've talked to who were surprised by it. But amazingly, they still continue to run the foundation. I know a lot of married couples, including my parents, who, are not even able to really be in the same room. So the idea that they're able to still co-run, a $50 billion foundation is quite extraordinary, actually. And I always thought they were both extraordinary people, and even more so now.
Sure. Well, and what's interesting, I did a little bit of research on Melinda, and she is a pretty smart person. I think she is easily his equal, maybe his superior in a lot of ways. And I think he realized that. I think that's why they connected on this logic level as well as this emotional level. So it's good. It's good that they're able to work things out. And really, I think that it's a good example because not just because you're divorced doesn't mean you have to hate each other. I think that, depending on what happened, theoretically, you should be able to work together and talk and co-parent. My parents got divorced, and I think like 10, 12 years later, they got remarried.
I've heard of that story before. It does happen.
It does happen. And so, I think the comedian Sinbad did the same thing. He got divorced. I think it was 5 years later they got remarried, and he said, nobody else could tolerate our weirdness. So, you got to find somebody who's willing to put up with your level of crazy. All right, let's get back to it. I think it's again extraordinary that this book set you on fire, and I want to talk about this because one of the things that your one of your points is that you think you have the ability to bridge these political divides, promote national unity, which we're sorely missing. And talk about this. Why do you think you have a sliver of a chance to lead the country and bring us back together?
Well, there's probably two big reasons. So one is because I am kind of purple in and of myself. And in fact, I wear a purple tie when I go on TV, and it's all over my website that I'm kind of a purple candidate. I'm running in the Democratic primary. But I think great ideas can come from all corners of the political spectrum. And some people have said, you're a libertarian. And it's actually true. I get Cato Institute documents sent to my house from time to time. But people have said, you're a progressive. And you know what? I agree with Bernie Sanders on Gaza. Like there, you can agree with different sides on different issues. And I really do, even people that I completely disagree with, I really respect and want to understand where they're coming from. And it helps me become smarter. It helps me understand the different kind of quadrants. So that's part of it. And then the second thing is that I, over the last few years, have run about 50 Jeffersonian dinners where I have gotten together people from different sides of an issue to talk about and try to solve complex, thorny problems. This actually started when I was at the Gates Foundation, where I would do these dinners. When you go into the University of Virginia, like I did, you go to Jeffersonian dinners almost as a rite of passage. And over time, if you really like them, you learn to perform them and do them. And they have a whole artistry and specialness about them where 15 people are at a table and it's a table conversation. And it's got to the point now where I can actually host these dinners and have hosted one to try to defuse a lawsuit between a foundation and one of its grantees, to try to bridge the divide between politicians on different sides of an issue. And I imagine if I get to the White House, I would actually host a dinner in the White House with 14 people or 15 people from both sides of the political spectrum. We would talk about, all right, so this immigration bill, there are problems with it. We can't seem to get over the finish line, and we're going to broadcast it to the whole country. And everybody's going to hear your positions, and you better be on your best behavior and show what it's like to actually disagree in a civil manner, and so we can figure out what are the compromise positions. And I've gotten to the point now where I can kind of call a vote in the middle of these, and my goal is usually to get it to be a unanimous vote. But in these, politician ones, you can never get unanimous votes. But I do think that skill would be interesting and could make for great reality TV as well as we try to conquer these thorny issues that are dividing our country.
Man, that would be extraordinary. Not only would it make great entertainment, but also just a valuable lesson that adults can come together, disagree, but be agreeable about disagreeing. They don't have to become jerks or violent or, we're seeing so much craziness where if a Republican, especially now, if a Republican aligns themselves with a Democrat or one of their ideas, they're going to get lambasted. They're going to suffer. And it's not so much the other way. If a Democrat aligns themselves with a Republican, yeah, that's a little bit of pushback, but not as much compared to the Republicans have become very combative on everything.
I do agree with that. That probably means that we're both Democrats. Like, I'm smart enough to kind of recognize my own biases there. But there are 32 congressmen and women who are part of the Problem Solvers Caucus, 16 Republicans and 16 Democrats. And that's how Joe Biden was able to get through some pretty big legislation, the CHIPS Act, the infrastructure bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, which really was mostly a climate change act. And it's because there was a little tiny bit of bipartisanship. And, right now, Washington is kind of sinking into the abyss as we
Right.
talk. There's probably going to be another government shutdown. Who knows if there will be aid for Ukraine or Israel? And it, wouldn't it be great if there could be a televised dinner where we all get in the room and guess what? The American people are going to see how you behave in this room. So.
And at the end of the dinner, there's a fun food fight just to get all just get it all out.
The
No,
sad part is, I know that the way American society has gone, someone will storm out of the room and
sure.
there will be some type of made for TV moment. But I do think the American people deserve to see who storms out of the room and who sticks through the hard conversation to the end.
Well, and you make a valid point. Look, the easiest thing to do is for you or I to storm out of the room.
Right.
I don't have an idea. I'm going to call you a name and I'm going to leave in a huff.
Right. Right.
Well, that's why divorce rates are high. That's why, people feel betrayed because they can't express themselves. They can't figure out how to have this tough conversation.
Yeah.
So instead of saying, hey, Jason or Bert, I don't agree with you. Maybe I don't have any ideas, but this doesn't feel right to me and whatever, they shut down and they do something crazy. And, I think of the actor Charlie Sheen when he had his meltdown.
Yeah.
Apparently, him and his in management. The producers weren't getting along, and I don't know exactly the details, but he chose a very public, very, I don't know, funny way of dealing with it, right? And yes, drugs might have played a part in there, but the drugs just really allowed him to behave in the way he wanted to behave. I don't think they were the cause. More of anything, they were, I don't know, a
Perhaps
really.
were a symptom of the stress he was under dealing, with that conflict that wasn't being resolved. I don't know. I do remember
Right.
that incident. Yeah, I definitely remember that.
So one of the things that I agree with, one of the points that you brought up is that the president can create jobs. And I think this is ultimately one of the pillars or one of the objectives of any good government is to be innovative and create more jobs, whether it's on a federal level or on a local level. I think, this is paramount to a presidency. Give me your thoughts on this.
Ah, thank you so much for asking this question because it allows me to really go deep on something that's I hint at on the website, but we haven't had time to turn it into something written yet. So we care about creating these jobs, these middle class jobs and better than middle class jobs for Americans, but we're not measuring it in as detailed a format as we should be. So as a very simple example, the jobs report comes out every month, and we there are 272,000 more net jobs, which, by the way, the net jobs thing kind of disguises the fact that it's like 4 million jobs gone and 4.27 million jobs created. There's a huge turnover in the job market every year. But what would happen if we actually upgraded the collection of that data to distinguish between kind of crummy jobs that pay, let's say, $10 an hour or less, or good jobs that have benefits that are kind of in the middle, like $15 to $25 an hour, to what we call quality jobs, which are salary jobs that pay $50,000 a year or more. And then even there could be professional jobs, et cetera. We should have that thing documented and tracked to extremely granular detail. There is a database maintained by the Labor Department that updates every 2 years with these codes for what the titles of the jobs are. And if we were really studying it at the atomic level, then we would know exactly how many ultrasound technicians there are, how many data analysts, how many data scientists. And if you knew that information and you had researchers tapping into it on a very regular basis, you could say, like, these are the jobs that are really growing. These are the courses and certificates and credentials you should earn to get those jobs. And I can see enough in this very fuzzy data to to see that credentials are growing really fast. These 6 to 12 month training programs where you get a certificate or a credential at the end, think like Google Analytics certification
Right.
or Microsoft SQL Server certification. Like some are in tech, but they're not all tech. Some are in healthcare, project management, manufacturing. Advanced manufacturing is growing a lot right now. And once you know that data, then you can actually implement policies to drive more jobs in those categories. And right now, it's almost like we're flying blind. We don't know where the jobs are coming from. We don't know what's creating them. We do know that small businesses create 67% of jobs. But if you double click on that, it's not any small business. Actually, new businesses created in the last 10 or 15 years are really the job creators. And you know this because you've been deep in this for a while, but we don't even keep track of that. Like, is this a new business? Is this an old business? That's kind of at the legacy part where it's, for example, oil and gas are kind of at you could say they're at the end of their life, but the end of their life could be 50 years of continuing to drill from the ground and create cash flow. Whereas these new businesses that crop up, like OpenAI just created 5 or 6 years ago, it's growing like a rocket. Its valuation is already $80 billion. And how many employees are they going to hire and how big are they going to get? We don't even track companies the way we should. And we're overly focused on the big old school companies and not focused enough on the fast growing, job creating startup companies. At least in the media, there's a lot of hype around startup companies, but we don't track it at the government data level. And that's why we can't actually implement the best policies. Sorry if I went a little bit off there, but that's
No,
the.
it's good.
There's a huge potential, and this is my area, and I would love to have the smartest minds in the country working for me in the Department of Talent, is what I would call it.
Oh, I like that.
I'd merge the education department and the labor department, and we'd be focused on helping make schools more connected to the labor force and helping us all be a lot smarter about how the labor force is evolving so we can actually implement policies that drive more of these quality jobs. We should even be studying how happy people are at their jobs. 80% of people are very unhappy at their jobs. What can we do to create more jobs that create happiness and fulfillment and purpose? We're so far away from that right now, but I see that as like a second term of my presidency thing. Once we figure out how to get more people to the middle class and more people to the American dream with quality jobs in the first part of my administration.
First of all, I love that. I would love to see that kind of report. What's growing? What's really not growing? What kind of jobs are being created? Because you're right. Again, it's this, I call it marketing. Hey, we created, like you said, 4.2 million jobs. Oh, by the way, we're not going to talk about the 4 million jobs that evaporated.
It's not even in the report. Like it's a lot of times it's not even there that it's a 239,000 net jobs. It's not even the total number of jobs. The last I saw, it's something like 40% of the workforce. Now, this might be slightly off, plus or minus 5%. 40% of the workforce changes jobs every year.
Wow.
There's a lot of jobs being created and destroyed every year.
Sure. Okay, so here's one of my pet peeves. I've had this issue. There's been what I call this propaganda, this programming that, you're supposed to go from a high school to college and you get this big degree so you can get this big job so you can get the big house and the big car and live this big life. But yet the reality is most people aren't going to do that. And second of all, we have trades, blue-collar workers that are being, I don't want to say maligned, but these jobs are important.
Oh,
And
they
I
are being
know.
maligned. You can say that word. We need to, we need to, the trades need to be made hot again because they
Yes,
actually are hot. You could
they
make
are.
$75,000 to $200,000 a year as a plumber, working with, construction, manufacturing. These jobs are all over the place, actually. And you can learn the skills when you're in high school. You don't have to wait until you're in college. Like a lot of these programs are available in high schools now around the country. I spent some time with the Pipe Fitters Union out in Colorado just 2 weeks ago, last week. It's all starting to blur. It was very recently. And there's so I somewhat ignorantly thought pipe fitters are mostly about plumbing, because that's where I see them is when they come fix the plumbing in my house. And they gave me a huge education about, oh no, there's all the city water that's running underneath all of the streets all over the place. We go and fix the Hoover Dam. We're involved with, all this the I would say water treatment facilities. I mean, it's like it was bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And those jobs pay very well.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. You know, the other thing that I've always found interesting about every industry that I've ever had the opportunity to consult with is just like the example you gave, we have the surface understanding of what pipe fitters are. And then you get this education and you go from, yes, this much, all of a sudden you realize it's like this huge thing and all the levels deep they go. And then you find out that there's one or two different associations, and there's a magazine, or maybe several mag. It just goes
Yeah,
on.
that's
It's
all true. I
incredible.
found out all the, exactly.
All right. I want to go back to the job thing because I think, again, this is going to be the number one issue as we move forward, not only in this election, but the next probably future elections forever. We have, I think, and you kind of alluded to it, we have some companies that are paying $10 an hour. I don't know how, if you're a if you are a teenager and you're living at home, $10 an hour is phenomenal. But if you're an adult, that's ludicrous. That's almost that should be illegal, in my opinion. It's like, there's such a huge disparity between a livable wage, which
Yes.
I don't even like that term because a livable wage is like, hey, you're breaking even.
Yeah, you're barely clearing some bar. Yes.
Right. You're living barely. And then so there, so you kind of alluded to this, there's a quality job and there's a sub quality job or subpar and sub and so what to you is a quality job versus a non-quality job?
So I actually have a whole white paper we're trying to get cleaned up so we can publish on this, but I'll give you the gist of it.
Okay.
A quality job is a salaried job that includes benefits and vacations. And this is one of my favorite things to ask at those Jeffersonian dinners is, what was your first quality job where you got paid a salary? And there's always interesting stories behind, how did you get that job and how did it change your life? So that's basically it. It's about $50,000 a year or more, although some economists think it should vary based on where you live. Like it might be 40,000 in a rural area and 70,000 in New York City, but you can basically think of it as $50,000 a year salaried with benefits. And it defines that you've entered the middle class when you get to that job. You are now, potentially living the American dream. You can actually get a home mortgage because you now have a salary. You might not be able to get as big a home as you want, but you could actually get the mortgage because you're going to get this consistent stream of payments. The banks assume, even though the average person only keeps their job for 2.7 years or something like that, they assume you're going to keep the job in perpetuity. The banks kind of still run on that principle. Or that you'll get some other job that pays the same amount or more. And at this point, we don't even know how many quality jobs there are in America. Like we have to guesstimate at that. And there's a group called Jobs for the Future that is going to attempt to help generate 75 million more quality jobs over the next 10 years. They were one of my grantees at the Gates Foundation. They're a phenomenal organization. Maria Flynn is their leader. And that's the mission that I'm on. If I get elected president, when I get elected president, is to actually put the full force of the federal government behind the vision that Maria and her team put out there.
All right. So here's a little bit. I'm going to put you on the spot with this one because this is what do they call it? Political dynamite? The third rail. Because one of the problems I see, and this is on both sides, okay? And I kind of consider myself more of a centralist. I used to be a hardcore Republican until they got in bed with the insurance companies
You should wear a
and it's
purple
gone.
tie too. It feels really good wearing those purple ties. Although
funny
ties are going
enough,
out of style, so maybe I need
yes.
to wear a purple headband. I don't know.
Purple shirt. I have
Purple
literally
shirt.
a closet full of purple shirts. It's actually one of my favorite colors, so it's
It's mine
perfect that
too.
you
It's
okay.
mine too.
But I have a huge problem with the government subsidies that we give some of the wealthiest industries in America. Beef industry, sugar industry, dairy industry, corn industry. It's literally trillions. It's definitely billions of dollars, and it's like, wait a minute, why aren't we pouring that money into small businesses or startups or I don't know, let's use that money and pay down the debt. Let's do something better with that money. What's your take on this? Am I wrong?
That is not a third rail for me at all.
Okay.
This is one of those areas where I'm lockstep with the Cato Institute that we do not need to be having corporate welfare for America's largest companies. If you are getting subsidies to mine minerals from the ground or plant more corn than you need, these subsidies will be going away in the Palmer administration. They are billions. They're not quite trillions, but there's quite a few of them. And some of these laws haven't been updated. The mining law dates back to 1872. So some of them haven't been updated in forever. And, you know, that's another thing that my administration will do that I haven't had time to put on the website yet is every 10 years, we need to actually review how has this law done compared to its original objectives? Has it met its impact objectives? Is it working? And if not, we should ask Congress, this law needs to be amended or this law needs to be set aside because it's not achieving its objectives. Unfortunately, we don't run things with this measurement mentality in mind in Washington. So some laws, like the 1872 mining law, they just kind of continue on forevermore unless some academic or person in a think tank says, hey, does this thing actually work? And then they look at it, you know, 27 years later. You know, we should be getting regular reports when these things come up for, I think of it as a 10-year renewal cycle on laws.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant idea because we do have some really old laws on the books that, you know, like the mining law you bring up and some of these other laws that don't make sense. We still have sodomy laws in some states, and it's just like,
Yeah.
you know, this is ridiculous. Let's move on. And now we kind of gone back in time with Roe versus Wade
That's for sure. Yeah.
and a bunch of men. I really do have a problem t men telling women about their reproductive health.
Yeah.
I have a problem with that. And look, and I've said this before, I don't think there's a woman who's ever had an abortion, and there may be a few who did it, you know, just flippantly. Oh, you know what? I'm pregnant. I don't give a crap. I'll just have an abortion. I want to continue partying on. I would suspect that most women take that seriously, and you know, it's a terrible decision to make. It's just
Yeah.
a terrible decision to make, and it's between them and their religious belief. That's kind of leave it at that. I would prefer that child be given up to adoption, but our adoption laws are just archaic as too. I mean, for
That
you and
too.
I to adopt a child here in America is so difficult. That's why people leave America and they go adopt in China and Europe and you know all these other places, because you can just go there and fill out the paperwork and you know they'll do some research, and less than I think 6 months you can adopt a baby. Here in
Yeah.
America, that child could be living in your home as a foster parent, and it may take you 3 to 5 years to adopt that child, and
Right.
it's a maybe. It's not even a guarantee, it's a maybe.
Yeah, the bureaucracies need to be reformed. And that's a big part of what I want to do with my administration and part of why I'm running is we can't just hire the it can't just be the same old civil servants that have always been there. Now, some of them are doing a very good job. But we
Sure.
need to infuse the public service with more people who come from businesses and industry, who are very talented in technology and processes and systems, and figure out how to make it so it takes only a year to adopt a child. That shouldn't be so difficult. Or to take a more, you know, pressing example right this very second, so you could process asylum claims within 30 to 90 days instead of 2 to 3 years. You know, we need 1,000 more judges at the border, asylum judges. And then we could actually process people as they're coming in. And only about 10% of people coming across the border are valid asylum claims. The other 90% want to come here for work. We should have a guest worker program for them if there's an employer that wants to pick them up and have them work for a summer in the fields or for a year doing some type of work. Let's make that program exist. But let's not just keep having this giant problem at the border or this lack of adoption going on. Let's actually solve these things one at a time with smart people and good process.
Absolutely. I'm an immigrant. I was born in Cuba, and I'm grateful for the politics that were happening in the 1960s, because otherwise I wouldn't be here. So I'm grateful. We do need to protect our borders. It's crazy not to think that we don't need to protect our borders. 60 Minutes, I had an episode, I think it's just 2 weeks ago, where they were saying, a large percentage, and I forgot what the percentage is.
The number of migrants arriving at the southern border is unprecedented. Last year, U.S. Customs and Border Protection recorded 2.5 million instances of detaining or turning away people attempting to cross into the United States from Mexico. So what's the fastest growing group among them? Chinese migrants. Yes, you heard that right, Chinese. We saw large groups, including many from the middle class, come through a 4-foot gap at the end of a border fence 60 miles east of San Diego. The illegal entryway is a new route for those hoping to live in America.
I don't trust Chinese nationals very much. We have a history of Chinese nationals who've come here, they get an education, they go work for a company, and they've been caught doing espionage over and over again. We have this terrible relationship with China. When I think of doing trade with China, what I think of is toxic toothpaste, toxic toys, toxic lumber, toxic sheetrock. I mean, they just want to destroy America. They are not looking to be our friend. They're looking to compete with us and take us down. And so, where at least the Latinos that are coming over, and again, yes, there's always going to be bad apples, people who do drugs and do terrible crimes, but that's a small percentage. We don't have a history of the Mexican nationals or the Latino nationals trying to take down a building or corrupt our infrastructure or anything like that. Take that in consideration when we're trying to decide, okay, who we're going to let in and who we're not. But I think our immigration policy is, again, archaic, and
It's super archaic. So I believe we should move to a talent-based immigration system,
Oh, I like
which
that.
would be in the Department of Talent, by the
Right?
way,
I
to
love
kind of
that.
round
Good
it out.
point. Yeah.
And you would get points based on having particular skills that we need in our
Right.
economy, whether you're going to be a taxpayer and you're already qualified for those quality jobs. Do you speak English? That would give you additional points too. Do you have
I
family
love
members
that.
here? Do you have a job lined up? This is similar to the systems that exist in Canada and Australia. They've both seen a huge influx in what I'll call talented, the world's best and brightest, who have expanded their economies and helped them grow faster. And that means they have enough money for their Social Security and Medicare. Meanwhile, we're laboring under a 40-year-old immigration system to that whole point. There hasn't been upgraded in so long. And, so we've got all kinds of people coming across the border, like you were just talking about, who then we don't have the ability to process them. So they just kind
Right.
of, blend into the society. And then we got all these people earning PhDs in our labs, and they can't get a green card after they graduate. So they get sent home, and they're just not willing to live here as an illegal or as an
Right.
undocumented immigrant. And it's a shame. We need to completely fix this system and be focused on attracting and keeping the world's best and brightest.
Right. Look, during the Trump administration, he was pretty harsh on immigration, and I think that was okay. Did he maybe go over he crossed the line a couple
He
times with
definitely
it,
went over the, yeah, over
but
many lines.
yes,
Yes.
but here's one of the lessons that I learned from it. We had these California farmers who had tons of crops that went
Went
unpicked,
bad because they
went
couldn't have
bad.
people, couldn't find people.
They couldn't find people. And even though they were offering, I think at one point they were offering $25 an hour, Americans weren't going to pick that crop, not even at $25 an hour. And it's just back
Have
to
you
your
ever
point.
gone apple picking or corn detasseling? These are hard jobs.
They're hard jobs. I do not find those what do you call it to be what do you call it? Something that interests me at all, right? I mean,
I
it's like,
don't
oh,
even
let's
like
go to the
putting
let's go to
together furniture from IKEA. I definitely.
Let's go to the apple orchard and pick apples. No, I'm not going to work for free and then pay them for the apples that I just picked. No. But again, tons of food went bad because there was nobody there to pick them. And I love your idea of having 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 more judges to help get through this process.
It's crazy that nobody talks about this. All politicians is almost like they're on autopilot. We need
They
more border
are.
control agents. We need more border control agents. We probably do still need a little bit more border control agents, but
Sure.
really we need many, many, many more judges to
Right.
actually
Well,
process things.
and here's kind of my idea. I'm gonna, put it in your idea bank. Maybe you'll use it, maybe you won't, but I think that
I have 1,000 ideas in that bank. Let's add
okay.
some more. Bring
Let's
it
add some
on.
more. By the way, I do the same thing. I have a notebook
Yeah.
and I come up with an idea and I write it down. And anyway, but I think that if somebody wants to come over here and work, especially if they're going to help our farmers, let's let them come over. And we charge them a small fee to come over because it costs us money to process them. Maybe we charge them $1,000, which they can pay over time. Well, we can
Right.
take that $1,000 to pay for the agents, to pay for the wall, to pay for the judges, to pay, I mean, when we have literally millions of people coming over and we charge a nominal amount, not only are they here, they get a permit, and I think that it will help offset the cost. And I'm thinking maybe both parties can get on board. Hey, the Republicans, hey, this is going to offset the cost and we can use the money for these other resources. The Democrats, because they want to let everybody in or whatever. So I think that that's kind of my thought. If we
I'm in
charge the
favor of
fee.
that on an even grander scale. That
Oh,
there's
I love
lots
it.
of things that the government does. Now it's, I'm a business person, so I think this way.
Right.
There are lots of things that the government does where it's not charging a user fee.
Yes.
And here you should have to pay for the cost of coming in here to be a guest worker or to become a citizen. It doesn't need to be that much, but it at least needs to cover the cost so that it's kind of a revenue neutral thing. And if you start thinking about it, then well, what about all those toll roads that we have out there? Like that should be paying for repairing the toll roads. There's no reason why Amtrak shouldn't be breaking even. In fact, every
No,
other
I hate that.
country has actually privatized their railroad. We should privatize our post office and our railroad too. There are some things that government does better, like a military, where we're not going to privatize our military, but there are many things that we should be privatizing or charging user fees. And that would allow us to reduce income taxes and actually get the budget into balance. And it's amazing that this hasn't been done. The biggest one, by the way, is that the federal government owns so much land. All these
Right.
military bases that are finished, where we could be selling off the land, they're in every city, basically. And a lot of times in very prime locations in cities as well, where you could clean up a waterfront, put in new hotels. We should be leasing or selling that land. Yeah, the federal government has not had a balance sheet since 2013, which is completely crazy since you're a business person and I am too. And I talked to Steve Rattner at an Aspen Institute thing because he participated in one of the commissions. And I said, why didn't it get adopted? He said, we did all this work together on it for a year and we came up with the balance sheet and nobody really wanted to do anything with it. They don't even use GAAP accounting. So that's even crazier. So, when we're increasing the payments that go to people for kind of transfer payments, that's totally different than when we're investing in making a bridge or building a new building, but we treat it all the same in the federal budget right now. We don't actually have depreciation the same way. We're not using GAAP. And there's a better way to run this railroad.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say I don't like the term cost neutral or breaking even because that's so very difficult to actually do.
Yeah.
I've never seen it in business. It's like, but it's I'm okay. I'm okay if the post office makes a profit.
That
I'm
shouldn't
okay.
be such a controversial statement.
Right. But
Yeah.
back to stupid laws, we have a law book. We have a book. I'm sorry. We have a law on the books that does not allow the post office to make a profit.
Right.
And it's ridiculous. Look, I hear people complain that they're paying whatever, 40, 50 cents for a stamp. Are you kidding? Where else
It
can
is
you move
50,
something?
I think 51. It's above 50.
Yeah, look, let's just make it a dollar and leave it there for a couple of years because how else can you get a envelope with whatever it is, 8 or 10 pages
Right.
from any state to any other state for 50 cents? That's a smoking deal.
Right. It is
That's a
still a smoking deal, like because you would have to pay $9.95 for the lowest option at UPS or
Right.
FedEx, probably the lowest option is $19 or $29. So
Right.
yeah.
It's a smoking deal.
Yeah.
And I think that back to your thing about measuring, We've all experienced going to a government office, and I want to say 80%, it seems like to me, 80% of the people there are dead. They have terrible attitudes. At the very best, they have a neutral attitude, like they're indifferent. We don't care whether you stay, pray, or lay. Just, I don't care. I'm just clocking time.
Right.
Then you have that 20% that have a great attitude. They stand out. They actually listen to you and then they want to help you. I just think that's incredible. But if we were measuring some of these talent, some of these people, some of these metrics, maybe they could be rewarded. And I know the government isn't set up for that, but maybe it could be.
No,
we got to
it
do
definitely
something.
can be. This is another thing we haven't changed in 50 plus years is the government service schedule. You're like a GS5, GS15. So right now, government workers are making less than they would in the private sector, but they still have pensions, which is not available in the private sector. And they have great health benefits too. We need to make it so you can make more money and you could be GS16, 17, 18. It shouldn't just be on seniority. It should be based on merit and talent. And that can be changed too. Like that's a non-sexy thing, but it could be really, really impactful if you could actually bring better people into the government and promote those 20% who are the really positive solutions-oriented ones. But you have to kind of imagine that the government can become like Google, or the government can become like pick your most innovative company. But it can be. There's no reason why the government has to be this sluggish, hasn't been updated in forever. That's why I always say we need to upgrade
Yeah.
our democracy.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. Unfortunately, it's just one of those things that won't be easy. It's going to be, I remember years ago when the Secretary of the Veterans Administration, is it Robert McDonald? Robert. Yeah. He came in and first of all, I think the only people that should be involved in anything with the Veterans Administration, they must have served on some level. We
Of
have these
course.
lawmakers that oversee the VA, but they've never served. And they don't understand. And I work with VA organizations, and they don't understand what our troops are going through. They could give a crap less. They make these promises and then they pull the rug or they break them. Anyway, so Robert McDonald
No, it's
comes
true.
in.
We don't do the right thing by our veterans at all. That's part of my policies to improve that.
And I think that if we're going to send people to war, the least we could do is take care of them when they come back. But anyway, so McDonald comes in and I think he fired like 1,000 people because they were doing really crappy jobs. And of course, these are government employees and somebody filed a lawsuit and those 1,000 people got their jobs back because the judge says, "Hey, I'm sorry, you didn't follow the process. These might be the worst people, and yes, they probably deserve to get fired, but you have to write them up. You got to go through this process." Again, the system has to be updated. A lot of our government agencies, including the FAA, are working on these horrible computers. It's just like
Right.
terrible.
Right.
Oh
No,
my gosh.
so much has not been upgraded. That's why I have a whole pillar of my campaign is about modernizing the government, upgrading the technology, upgrading the human resources, everything you're talking about. It's not sexy, which is why I made it my third pillar, to be honest,
Right.
but it actually might be the most important.
Yeah. Sometimes the least sexiest things are the most important. Look, discipline, not sexy. Accountability, not sexy. But discipline and accountability is what's going to make you the most successful.
That's the same area that has government accounting reform and balanced budget. Like these are all things we know we should be doing, but we're not focusing on them enough. And they're core to if we want to put our country back on track, you got to get these things done. They're the basic blocking and tackling.
Right. All right. I want to talk about this. We got these two old folks running. Biden is 80 or 81.
81.
Trump is 78,
77.
77.
77. Yeah.
Once, in my opinion, Biden is too old and Trump is too, I don't know, crooked, too off-centered, too erratic. too unstable, whatever, you know, he's
He's
not a
not
good
fit
leader.
to serve,
He's not fit
definitely.
to serve. He is not a good leader, you know, by any measurement. If you go down the list, what makes a good leader, you will see that Trump meets none of these. But
Puts these people before himself.
right. Doesn't
Oh.
take responsibility. Speaking of
Doesn't take
accountability, doesn't learn.
accountability or
Doesn't.
responsibility. Does he tell the truth? Does he have integrity? No. They're
You
all
know,
emphatic no's.
right? It's like, I wonder if his name is actually Donald J. Trump at this point, because he lies so much about everything. You know, before I got to know him as a president, you know, I admire him because he doesn't drink. He says he doesn't drink and doesn't take drugs. And I always admire his level of energy. And let me tell you, now that I've gotten to know him as a president, and he does lie so much, I'm thinking he must take something. There's no way that somebody so obese could have so much energy, because he runs circle around any of his opponents. He does have this miraculous energy. It's got to come from somewhere. I don't know if he's just mainstreaming caffeine. He's, you know, supposedly drinks a lot of
Supposedly doesn't
Coke.
drink coffee either,
Yeah, he doesn't
so
drink coffee, but I think he does drink Coke, so maybe he's mainstreaming that. But I don't know. I just find that amazing. But I will give him points for his energy. But let's go back to the age thing. I think it's time for Biden. And Biden did say he wouldn't run again if Trump wasn't running. But I think Biden needs to move over and give somebody younger with a little bit more zest, a little bit more energy, like yourself or somebody else. And I think
No, not
Biden's gonna.
somebody else, like myself. Let's keep
Okay, like yourself, Jason Palmer. Okay, the deal is, I think he has gotten too old. And I have a problem. Look, Orrin Hatch is somebody that I liked. He should have retired. We have what is this lady who died? I think
Diane Feinstein, you mean?
Feinstein.
Paul
Come on,
Feinstein.
you should have retired. Pelosi, you need to just stay retired. Just go find something else to do. You can influence policy in a different
I
way.
will stick up for Nancy Pelosi that she did eventually step back, and now
She
Hakeem
did.
Jeffries is in charge. Like that's what Joe Biden should do at this point. He should be like George Washington and say, I was going to be a transitional figure. I've done my work. I passed these three major pieces of legislation. Now I'm riding off in the sunset to my Mount Vernon in Delaware, and and have at it, because there are a lot of great people. I mean, I was kidding a little bit before. I would love to be president. I think I would be a great president, but there are many great people in the Democratic Party. You got Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, you've got Gavin Newsom in California, Jared Polis in Colorado. Some people like Ro Khanna, he's a congressman in California from Silicon Valley. You could even say like Mark Cuban would be somebody who I would say, he's a billionaire. He's done more with business than I've done. That type of person is who we need to rerunning the country. Some people have mentioned JP Morgan's Jamie Dimon as a possibility. He's also kind of a purple candidate, like myself. Not even sure if he's a Democrat or a Republican, but there are a lot of great people who could be leading the country who are in their 50s or their 40s or even 60s would be considered young these days. Let's let the new crop of leaders pass the torch to them.
Well, I think you're right. In fact, I'm going to text Mark right now, and you brought it up. Hey, Mark, would you consider running for president? And let's see if he responds during the show here.
If he responds no, say you've got a presidential candidate here who would love to talk to you about bringing the country together, because Mark is on my list of people that I do want to meet. One of the things I'll go ahead and announce on your show is that I'm in the process of creating a super PAC. The super PAC is going to be called Together, and it's going to be focused on trying to bring the country together by trying to get 20 young people elected to Congress this fall. And it's going to be both Democrats and Republicans. We want people who agree to be part of the Problem Solvers Caucus to grow that group from 32 to 52, hopefully. And I did something similar back in 2018 when I announced publicly on Facebook that I wanted to help get 20 women elected to Congress. And I put the whole list up. And then Bloomberg found out about the list and they blew it up even bigger. And they put a lot more money in than I did. And 16 of the 20 women end up getting elected to Congress. And I want this fall, the big story is to be all these young people got elected to Congress on a platform of solutions, on moving the country to conscious capitalism, kind of a purple approach. I would love Mark Cuban to be one of the people that I work with on that.
Well, I will let you know. Let's see. Sometimes it does take them,
If you got a text back that fast, then you are
I
very special.
and I'm not that special. Sometimes it does take a day or two for, we'll see. Anyway, okay, conscious capitalism. What the heck is that? What do you mean by that?
So conscious capitalism, but I didn't invent it. Conscious
Right.
capitalism is a movement of people who are focused on the idea that businesses can be for good. This shouldn't be such a controversial idea. And in fact, there's four principles of it: that you have conscious leadership, that you put your people first, that you're trying to do more than just make profit. You exist for a double bottom line or a triple bottom line. All the companies that I invest in would qualify as conscious capitalism in some way. And it's a somewhat amorphous term, but some states have started to codify it now. In fact, it's up to 40 states now have laws for what are called B corporations. And most people don't know it, but the vast majority of companies are C corporations or LLCs. And the law says that your primary purpose, in fact, your only purpose, is to make profit for your shareholders if you're a C corporation. And I went to Harvard Business School. I love capitalism. I think that it's great to make as much money as you want. C corporations should exist. But some people have decided, usually later in life, or if you have kind of more of a social mission orientation, that you might want to start a B corporation where you want to be about profit, but you have other objectives, like you want to make sure you're developing your people. You want to serve your customers first. I just heard that Ralph Nader came out with a book very recently about 12 CEOs who got it right. And I looked at the CEOs that were in there, and it's conscious capitalist companies like the CEO of Patagonia, Herb Kelleher from Southwest. Like these are, famous CEOs who the company was more holistic. It wasn't just about profit. Now it could be maniacally focused on metrics. I'm maniacally focused on metrics, but it's not just the metrics of profit. It's like long term. Are we developing our people? Are we serving our customers more than just one transaction at a time over the lifetime of that customer relationship? And my grand theory of the case here is that if B corporations get taxed at 15% corporate tax rate and C corporations get taxed at 25% corporate tax rate, more and more big companies are going to say, how do I change myself into a B corporation so I get the lower tax rate? Well, you put your people first, you focus on the environment, the community, all these other things, and we will have a much better, more equitable society if that comes to pass.
I think that's great. I think that I could see a lot of C Corp saying, yeah, let's just transition to B Corp and we'll fake it because, it's easy to fake. It's just like what do you call it? On a lot of these airlines, you can, I guess, donate money to them to set off offset emissions, which is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in
I
my
did see
life.
that on one of the plane tickets I bought. Like, do you want to spend $72 extra to offset your admissions? I'm like, what?
No, I want to spend $72 million and have my own jet. I don't want to spend $72 for offsetting emissions. That what are they going to do? They're going to go buy emission credits from somebody else. It's the most ridiculous thing. And so this is something that I do have a problem with. I would love to protect our environment. I spent an enormous amount of time in Hawaii. I spent a lot of time in Puerto Rico now, and
Beautiful
Hawaii
places there.
specifically, these people are, living below the poverty line. I think there was a report that said to live in Hawaii, you need a minimum of $110,000, which very, very few people make $110,000 on the
That
islands.
are native to the islands, yeah.
Yeah. And the problem I have is that we've done this environmental thing to our detriment. It started with the turtle with the straw in the nose, which I think was faked. At first,
Right.
I thought I reacted like everybody else. Oh my gosh, this is terrible. I scuba dive and I've been around these turtles a lot. I'm going, you know what? Chances of a turtle getting that up its nose, first of all, the straw is going to be floating on the surface. Anyway, it's just like winning the lottery. And for the turtle to leave it there and the photographer take a picture of it, another lottery. But anyway, like, again, back to emissions, we have the electric vehicles. I don't know if you've seen this video on C-SPAN where the guy, and it's not a hostile video, it's not like they're being rude, it's actually a very educational video where the congressman is saying, hey, if all the cars were electric tomorrow, how much impact would that have on our, green grass or whatever
Climate,
the, yeah. And he said like 2%. It's this tiny percentage. And then he goes on, well, does it take more materials to make the EV cars? Yes, because the batteries are very involved. And so we're not really helping the environment. It sounds like we are when you think about the electric vehicles. And if you don't have to leave your immediate circle, one of the other problems with electric vehicles is that they run out of batteries. So if you and I had to evacuate Los Angeles and we're driving an EV, we're going to get stranded most likely on the freeway. There's just no way you're getting out of California quickly if it has to be evacuated, at least not out of Los Angeles or San Diego or Sacramento. You're going to be stranded on the freeway. So I think that we're making too big of a deal with the environment. Do we have to protect it? Yes. Do we have to be responsible? Yes. But I think the pendulum has swung too far over. Your thoughts?
It's a matter of degrees. I definitely agree. Like one stat that you will probably appreciate is that our carbon emissions have gone down by 20%, the whole United States of America, over the last 20 years. But no one will ever say that. But I think we should take a little bit of credit for that because that means we actually have done some good things. We've gotten better gas mileage. We have some people driving electric cars. I still think it's less than 5%. I have a Tesla. I love my Tesla. I do recommend everybody go get an electric car. They're great. But I don't think we should be mandating that people buy electric cars. We should provide incentives so that they buy electric cars. We should encourage it. We should move towards that direction for the sake of the environment. But if we really want to solve, if climate change is your big issue, and it is a big issue for a lot of Democrats, then that's a really complicated problem to solve because US is doing okay. If we've reduced emissions by 20%, the real problem is over in India and China, their emissions have gone through the roof. And so that's a really complicated problem to solve. How do you get Indians and Chinese citizens to be buying electric cars or to be stopping using coal plants? Like the whole thing where Biden was saying, like, I don't want any more oil being drilled in the US, or I don't want any more coal-fired plants. It's not the problem of coal plants in the US. That's way down. That's almost at the bottom at this point. There are very few coal plants left. They're all in China. They're all in India. That's really where we need to address this if we're going to solve climate change. And that's a wicked hard problem, quite honestly, but nobody really talks about it that way.
Yeah, it is a very difficult problem. I don't want to sound like it's not, but
And
you
you're right,
mentioned.
the cars are part of the solution, but a bigger part is we got to upgrade our transmission lines. Right now, we still have, like, if you just look at the power lines that we have, these power lines 30, 40 years old, haven't been upgraded. We have much better ways to upgrade transmission lines now so that we lose less through heat and we lose less through just the bad conduction in the materials. There's construction. Concrete is a huge contributor. Like 8 to 10% of our carbon emissions comes through the processes we use to make concrete right now, but it would double the cost to use the new types of concrete. We could be putting windows in everybody's house that, like, automatically when the sun goes through, you could actually get energy from the window. This has already been invented and is already in a number of, like, top-end LEED buildings. But there's no reason why you couldn't buy windows. But it's going to be a million little innovations is what's going to eventually get us there, not a million regulations.
And I like that because you're right. I was watching a video where these guys have come out with a shingle, the shingles connect, and
Yeah,
their
that's
solar
right. You could put a
panels.
whole roof on your house. I think Elon Musk even has one of those coming out soon where you
I think
could.
so too. But you were mentioning India, and I think one of the reasons their emissions have gone up is, first of all, they're going through the industrial process. Number
They
two,
are.
they're receiving a lot of our trash. I mean, there's tons of documentation that, the US and Europe sends India and some of these other third world countries a lot of the trash. And you see these people that are picking through the parts to get the little bit of gold and whatever that they, you know, it's reusable, you
Those
know. And
metals, yeah.
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 And
Yeah.
so,
It's not even gold, it's just copper, but
oh,
it's still
so,
valuable. Yeah.
yeah, whatever it is, the different components that they're able to get whatever material. But yeah, it is again, back to your example with the job report, it's misleading. You know,
Right.
because you said that, hey, we've lower our emissions by 20%, and that means what to us in the US? Does it mean, you know, I mean, we're still having air quality issues, we're still having what do you call it? To your point, we're having all these regulations.
Right.
Newsom wants to outlaw gasoline cars by what, some ridiculous date, and it's like he doesn't even have the energy now to turn to keep the lights on, and he wants to. In fact, when they were having problems last summer, that he asked, "Hey, stop charging your cars." What? I mean, it's like
Right. No,
it's frustrating.
the
It's
whole thing, I
frustrating.
would flip that whole thing around. We can actually have a pro innovation, green energy agenda that's about, you know, electrifying our transmission network, upgrading our power plants. We should be introducing nuclear power plants again. The technology has gotten much better. Solar, we can do much more with solar. One of the most impressive things I saw was a map of like how many solar panels would need to be deployed across the entire state of Arizona in order to power all of the US. And you think like, oh, it would have to be like the whole state. But no, it's like this little tiny corner up in the corner of Arizona. If we had enough solar panels to fill one small corner of Arizona, we would actually generate enough electricity. So I think solar is going to be the biggest outperformer over the next 10 years. But we need to be encouraging more jobs, green energy jobs. There's 25 million of them to be had. And this isn't about regulating old industries to death. It's about supporting new industries and new jobs.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Look, the solar technology has improved tremendously. I think, you know, years ago, Governor Schwarzenegger came out with an initiative. He wanted to, I think he called it the $1 million, 1 million solar roofs or something like that. And I think that could be mandated by government in the sense of not old buildings, but any kind of new development, new office buildings, new homes having 20%. What do you call it? Solar panels, and do some kind of incentive, rebate, tax, you know,
I would
tax.
definitely do it by incentives, not
Yeah.
mandates. At least
Yeah.
that's the
Thank
Jason
you.
Palmer way. But
Yeah.
yeah.
I like that. Let's do it the Jason Palmer way. Let's do it by incentive because incentives are always better. But I think that places like Phoenix, like Las Vegas, let's see, or I should say Arizona, and
Yeah,
then
New
parts of,
Mexico.
yeah, New
These are all
Mexico,
Texas,
Nevada, all,
highly.
yeah,
Yeah.
solar would do really well. We have certain areas where solar would do so much better than anything else. And so I think that could be incentivized very well. I think that
It's kind of already happening. So my sister just got solar put on her house in Nebraska. So like all the way
oh,
up to
interesting.
Nebraska, you can now get the panels installed and you get paid back over 15 years. But there are some small but important law changes that need to happen. Like the most important one is that the power company needs to be willing to buy back the energy
Yes.
that you create. Now, part of the reason why it gets stalled, as a business person, you'll appreciate this, is that some states have tried to say, well, you pay, you know, $15 per kilowatt hour. Should be able to sell it back for 15. Well, it's not exactly how it works. Usually, when you're selling something back, maybe you might get, you know, 50% the price of what you would
Right.
pay if you bought it fresh from the manufacturer. And we probably should just find that balance, whatever it is, 50%, 70%, something like that, so that all the states have this in law. And that's one of the type of things I would try to do if I were president is like, let's not force the power companies to accept 100% on the
Right.
dollar for
There's
everything that
no,
you sell back. Yeah.
right. Again, back to incentive. There's no incentive. I'm a
That's right.
business person. Why am I going
Right.
to buy something for the same price I'm going to sell it? I
But if
have no
they could buy
profit.
it back for half price, now all of a sudden you're the cheapest producer in their network. They would buy that all day long.
All day long.
So,
All day long. And so it's amazing because, you know, when Enron and companies like Enron, when they sell energy, they're not making a 50% markup or 100% markup, right? They're
Right.
slivers. 10, 15% is considered big.
Right. That's right. That's right.
So yeah, you're right on there. I mean, if all of a sudden we're selling it back to them at 50%, man, they would love it.
That's why when I hear that they're opposed to it, I'm like, well, what are you trying to price at? Oh, I see. So you're charging them more than they would get from their gas-fired plant, and I know why they're unhappy about that.
All right, something that we should have probably started at the beginning, and that is, give us a quick rundown. What is your background? You've done business. I know you've been involved in a couple
Yeah,
of
we
companies.
jumped right into it. We jumped right into it. So I started three companies right out of college, which we could go into, and sold two and failed spectacularly with the third, which is actually sometimes the most fun to talk about because I learned the most lessons. Then I went and worked at Microsoft for 3 years on a learning management system of the future. You could think of sort of like e-learning 20 years before its time. Bill Gates came up with a great idea of we're going to make all these tablet PCs, and we want to have an interactive learning system. And I worked on that back in 2002. So, very, very long time ago before its time. And then I ended up having a series of jobs, partly because I chose this as a 25-year mission that I would work at the intersection of education, technology, and entrepreneurship for 25 years. And my goal was to help lift 1 billion people out of poverty by working at that intersection. And that led me to a series of executive roles at SchoolNet, the Gates Foundation, New Markets, the funds I've been running, and Kaplan, where I was a turnaround CEO in the middle as well. And over that time, I do think the companies I've worked with, the colleges I've worked with, when we tally it up, we've helped about 100 million people improve their lives, either get credentials or get degrees or diplomas. So not quite pulling people out of poverty like my original mission. But I've ended up focused much more on the US than globally, which is when I first invented the mission, I thought it would be more of a global type mission. So I've been a turnaround CEO, an entrepreneur, and most recently have invested in about 35 education and workforce technology companies. I don't know if you've heard of any, but I'll tell you about a couple of them. So Credly is one of the most successful. They actually provide the credential infrastructure for Google Analytics certificates and Microsoft, six of the top 10 tech company certificates. They also work with 1,000 colleges and universities to do digital certificates and digital degrees. They were recently acquired by Pearson for $200 million, and that was, publicly available because Pearson is a publicly traded company. Another one I've worked with is a company that does education for people in prisons and jails. They're in 13 states and 81 prisons and jails. It's called Origin. I'm very proud of that company. It's growing really, really fast and still only has like 1% of the prison and jail market. It's really helping people reduce recidivism, help them get credentials while they're in prison or jail. And then another company would be a company called Mersion, which does virtual reality training to improve people's social emotional skills. It really originally started out as an in-classroom thing that some colleagues at the Gates Foundation funded, where teachers would get a simulator basically to pretend like teach a simulated class. And then those teachers did better when they went to the real class. And a little company was created to do this. There's patents on the technology. And then they got McKinsey to sign up and do leadership training using the same software. And then Best Western wanted to train their hotel desk clerks. And then Starbucks wanted to train their store managers. And before you knew it, 300 Fortune 1000 companies of customers. And they were named by Fast Company, one of the most innovative companies a couple of years ago. And there's 35 companies like that that we've invested in across five funds over the last 20 years.
Wonderful. I love that. Yeah, that's great. Lot good experience. Jason, with your technology background, and I know that there's some information out there about you doing something with AI. Talk about this.
Sure. So that you must have like really good ears or something, because earlier today we announced and launched the first presidential AI that has ever been launched by a campaign. If you go to my website at palmerforpresident.us and you click on the little link that says palmer.ai, you can ask my digital avatar any question that you want about my campaign, my policy positions, even hypothetical situations. And I will say back to you exactly what my policy is and explain to you why. And I have to admit, my team and I, we looked at the alpha product the last couple of days. They're like, Jason, this AI is better than you on a few things. I'm like, it is me. These are my policies. But it doesn't say or huh. It just, it's a much smoother delivery than my delivery.
Sure. Speaking of AI, though, and I can't wait to check it out.
You should check it
But
out. It's super fun to play with, actually.
I think that's definitely what do you call it, the wave of the future.
I do think every campaign will have one of these next time around. I mean, it's partly because you need to know, like when I send out text messages as part of our marketing campaign, a lot of people will write back, like, what's your position on veterans? What's your position on Gaza? What's your position on abortion? There are certain key issues. And you can ask, if you can ask me the three questions you really care about, be like, oh, I met that guy. I know what he believes in.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. I think that's a, I'm going to go check it out. That I think is a phenomenal marketing tool. It's interactive video. So what better way to get to know the candidate than to be able to AI or ask questions through their AI avatar?
Exactly.
I mean,
Exactly. And
that
I
right
should mention
there.
at the same time, we're multimedia here. I mean, I'm a startup technology guy. So we also have emails going out that are not just the standard marketing emails. It actually says it's from Palmer AI. And it says, like, you can reply to this marketing email and we will, the AI will reply. And we're already getting emails back.
Back and
And
forth.
then after like two or three back and forth emails, we're going to say, we don't want to do email anymore. Click this button and talk to me directly. And it'll lead people right to the AI that's on the website.
That
So,
is extraordinary. I mean, is that a, it seems like a service right there. I
well,
mean,
actually, we have a, we are kind of batting around. Should we sell people like their own version of their own AI if they want to put it up on their website like this? Because it could be just you. It could actually do the whole podcast. You don't even have to be here. You could just like feed it the 12 questions and let the AI do the rest.
you know, one of the things that Joe Biden had is that he's been in politics forever. That's both good and bad. But
50 years of public service. Great public service.
50, yep, 50 years of public service. You know, he's been involved in different caucuses and commissions, and you know, obviously he was a VP and now he's president. So he knows the system well. But it is, I think, time for him to say, you know, so long, let me give somebody else a try. One of the things I wanted to ask you is I think, and I could be wrong with these numbers, I think that he they were the media was talking that he was able to raise, was it like $80 million in a couple of weeks, or maybe it was $40 million. It was a huge amount of money. And they were comparing the, you know, the during the same time frame, Trump was like a tenth or a 20th of that. My question to you is, obviously, when you're running for presidency, the presidency, it's a huge amount of money. And
It is.
do you
It
see
is.
yourself raising that kind of money to stay in? Because one of the things that are against outsiders like yourself is the funding, and you need it. So how do you overcome that?
Totally. I have definitely discovered that there is a Democratic funder network that exists, and it is 95% behind Joe Biden. I did know that coming in. Like, I'm not Michael Bloomberg. I'm not a billionaire. I actually am someone who has done okay for myself, but this is, fundraising is a key part of my strategy here. And we have gotten a number of donations at this point. But to be honest with you, this is probably 90% self-funded at this time. And I know why other candidates are dropping out, like Marianne Williamson dropped out of the Democratic primary. Dean Phillips did very well in New Hampshire, but he was just on Twitter today saying he thinks he's going to get less than 10% in Michigan. And I know he laid off a lot of his staff last week. It's hard. It's hard. Some people, I think, hire two big staffs. We have a very small, tight team of six or seven of us right now, depending on how you count one person who's part-time. And it's a difficult thing. So I'm going out half of my week this week is going to be fundraising, getting more people to decide whether to re-up in the campaign. And this Super Tuesday is going to be a very important day. We have two places that we want to actually get a big enough percent that we earn delegates for the convention, and possibly in our dream scenario, we might actually win one of those places. And that'll help put us on the map more. But we've done better and better each state that we performed in so far. And we feel like we're the slow but steady, that as others kind of fall away and run out of money, I'm stewarding the money much more carefully, running this capital efficiently like a startup. And I know my team always says to me, Jason, this isn't a startup, this is a campaign, but it really is quite similar to a startup. It really, really is. And knock on wood, my plan is to be the last one standing when Joe only has one more competitor to knock out and get the nomination.
That's good. That's a good plan. And, to your point, in my opinion, I think you're doing better than Bloomberg. Here's Bloomberg. Not only is he a billionaire, but he owns a media outlet.
Right.
Nobody even knew he was running. I mean, it was just ridiculous. There was two billionaires that ran
Right.
last time. There was Bloomberg, and there was, what was his name,
Tom
Stahl or
Steyer also ran.
Steyer. But so it goes to show you that it's not just money. You need to have a message. You need to be able to resonate and connect with the audience, because Bloomberg had tons of money, and he spent, like they said, close to $1 billion. It's like $600-700 million. And
There's a guy that was running in the Republican race. Ryan Brinkley is his name. And he just dropped out after raising and spending $80 million. I will tell you, not confidentially, because I'm sharing it with everybody who watches your podcast, that I've spent less than 1/100th of that amount of money. And I think we're having a much bigger impact on the discussion, the debate. When I was campaigning up in Nevada, like Joe Biden actually came to Nevada in the final 2 days of that campaign. And I know because his schedules were published that he wasn't planning to come to Nevada before. Now, I don't know that I got such a big percent, but there were a few articles or a few TV commercials. Like, we were actually trying to put on a real campaign. So that the goal is to get Joe Biden out of his shell and campaigning. We need to win over young voters. We need to win over independents, and we need to create enough energy, because otherwise Trump has a lot of energy behind him, and there's no way that someone who's kind of staying put in the White House could possibly beat the Trump juggernaut. You've got to run a full-fledged campaign. And that's why people like Ezra Klein just came out a week ago saying, like, what can we do? How can we solve this? Because Joe might have been a great president with all these laws that he passed, but he's not a great campaigner, and he's not even campaigning for the most part. To give up the Super Bowl interview, that's completely insane. That's probably worth $20 million in free advertising.
Absolutely. And I think, in my opinion, him not campaigning is either arrogance or ignorance. Because, to your point, Trump can do no wrong. He's got this juggernaut. He may not win the presidency, but he's going to give you a big run for the money. And if
I think he's on path to win the presidency unless we have a change of energy. Now, I'm not going to say it has to be a change of candidate. We need a change of energy. Like, if all of a sudden Joe was spending as much time on campaigning as he is on foreign affairs, this would be a totally different thing. But he really is kind of sucked into a quagmire of foreign affairs right now. And that's also an area where the United States people doesn't really support more engagement in international affairs. They want focus on
Less.
investing in our people here at home. And so the more they hear about Ukraine, or the more they hear about Gaza, the more they just think he's not caring about me. He's caring about something else.
Well, and I think, again, people need to go and look at history. If people will look at the way we got involved in World War II, everybody says now, hindsight being 2020, we should have gotten involved sooner. We didn't get involved, that we if we would have gotten involved sooner, we would have avoided this and avoided that. And I think that, I think that these wars that are going on, we have to either support it or not support it. We
You can't
can't
be
be.
half pregnant with this thing.
Yeah.
When Putin invaded Ukraine, and then there was that Republican debate where everybody was saying, like, I don't think we should be involved with it, blah, blah, blah. I immediately went out on LinkedIn, which is not even really a place where you're supposed to post on politics, and reminded people of how Hitler had taken over Czechoslovakia and Poland because he was trying to reunite all the German-speaking peoples. And this is literally exactly the same thing that Putin was saying about Ukraine is not a real country. There are all these Russian-speaking people here, and I want to recreate Greater Russia. And he basically explained the same thing on the Tucker Carlson interview the other day when he went on for 30 minutes about kind of the history of Russia and that Russia should include these territories. And if we hadn't intervened, well, I should say, like, it was the most successful post I've ever done on LinkedIn, even though it was all about history and politics and that history was repeating itself here and we have to support the Ukrainians. But now we're also to a point where it's been kind of a stalemate. There was a picture in the New York Times, a graphic of where the battle line has been, and it's been almost exactly the same place for the last 2 years. There really is a stalemate. It's like the end of World War I, where they were at the Maginot Line and everybody was kind
Right.
of shooting each other, and there was no progress. And I do think at this point we need to pass the aid to support the Ukrainians, and then we need to immediately get into peace talks to try to finish this thing out. And maybe Russia gets to keep Crimea, or maybe Russia gets to keep a little corner of Ukraine. Everybody will be very up in arms. I don't think you'll hear any other presidential candidate explain this. But if we don't, this war is going to go on for 5 more years, and Putin is going to win because he's going to wait us out. He has
Yes.
longer staying power than we do. So we have to understand our own people are already losing interest. Like, you can see it going down. And so we have to work with the Ukrainians to figure out a way to finish this war in the next year after we give them the funding.
Yes, it is time to piss or get off the pot. I just looked at my phone and no, I have not heard back from Mark, but let's see what we can do there to connect you guys. It has been it's been a blast having you on the show. I would certainly
Yeah,
love to bring you.
we went totally past the 60-minute limit, but I've been having
Yeah.
fun. I hope
Thank
you've been
you.
having fun too.
I have too. I think it's been I think it's been a lot of fun, and I'm always a big I believe that if you and I are having fun, the audience will have fun. So hopefully that'll be true. But yeah, it's been great. And I certainly appreciate you stopping by. And man, I hope that worst case scenario, you wake Biden up. Like you said, maybe we don't
Yes.
need to change candidates, but we do desperately need to change energy. He's almost invisible. And when he does speak, it's not with a high amount of energy, which goes to the whole age thing.
Right.
And you know, when you listen to Trump speak, it might be completely 100% inaccurate, completely false, but he has energy. He has this incredible amount of self-belief. It may be a lie, but he believes it. And that
Well, unfortunately, it's not just him. His people believe it
is,
too. And when
yeah,
you
his.
come with that much energy and you get the crowd riled up, like, that's how you win elections.
Yes.
And Joe Biden has been a great public servant for 50 years, but he's never been known for energizing crowds.
Right.
And now he's not even seeking out crowds. So this is a big problem. And I really hope there's only a few people that could actually convince him to do the George Washington thing. And I think that would be Jill Biden could talk to him. I
Right.
think if Barack Obama spoke with him, that's another possibility. So Barack or Jill, if you're out there, Joe has done a wonderful job as a great public servant, but we really need to pass the torch to a new generation of Americans. And I'm putting myself out there in hopes that Joe notices me and in hopes that he opens up the playing field. I would love nothing more than to see other great candidates get into the race and try to win the nomination.
Yes, I agree with you. Come on, Jill. Come on, Barack. Let's do it for the party. Jason, thank you so much for stopping by.
Bert, this was a wonderful. Thanks so much for having me.